So this is the first time they ever pitched any of my songs, and they pitched a song for my second album to Johnny Hallyday's people. And Johnny Hallyday is like the biggest rock star in the history of France. He was, you know, contemporary of Elvis, and, you know, in the French speaking world, you know, he kind of is Elvis. Like that was him. But he was, you know, still going like into the 2000s. Anyway, and his people liked one of my songs, and then he liked one of my songs, and more importantly, his wife liked one of my songs. And so they commissioned a French lyric for it. And he ended up recording it, and it ended up winning the Grammy in France for the best song of 2014.
Hi, I'm Nick.
I am Bonsu.
And I'm Bryn, and this is Chalk It Up, a podcast that celebrates all things Sussex through stories and conversations with inspiring local people.
In this episode, we talk to musician and songwriter David Ford. David rose to fame in the early noughties with the band Easy World and went on to have a really successful solo career. And he's toured the world with the likes of Elvis Costello and Gomez and Katie Tunstall. He's been described by The Guardian as one of Britain's best performers and singer-songwriters. We had a really good conversation with David. He was really candid with us and very quickly got into talking about, you know, his love for music and the art and the science of songwriting and why it's so important to him. We loved recording this episode, and we hope you enjoy listening to it.
It's actually quite rare, I think, for people to know at that relatively young age exactly what you want to do, right? You know, I've always been extremely envious of anyone that's really clear-minded about what they want to do, despite the fact that this band. So what was it that, whether it was about this band, or what was it that about playing music that just really sort of set you on that path?
It was just songs. I found that I just loved songs and their ability to make me feel all kinds of different things, and how sometimes you could be listening to some music and suddenly just it would always be like the combination. There'd be a moment, it'd be a combination of lyric and melody that would just like suddenly shock you, and you find like this tears rolling down my face and things. I just wouldn't. And it was the discovery that music had the power to do that to me, and then the thought that maybe I just became obsessed with the idea that I could do that to other people, and so I wanted to I sort of wanted to understand the mechanics of it, not so much in a, maybe mechanics is the wrong word, but I sort of wanted to understand that. I suppose it's where mechanics meets psychology, yeah. Where how you can use the combination of musical forms and musical devices, along with literary devices, and then use that in conjunction with your understanding of human psychology to try and make people feel things through music.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a highly pretentious and overblown thing of saying like I wanted to write songs, but it was really genuinely about that. It's like I couldn't believe that I could listen to music and it could be so kind of viscerally awe-inspiring. And so it's kind of been like a lifetime's pursuit of that, really.
And when it works, when you do hear those songs and it hits you, I mean, it's magic, isn't
yeah.
it? Like, when
yeah.
a song really hits you, it's absolute magic. When you were sort of getting into songwriting, what was sort of coming easier to you? Was it the musical side, the structure side, or was it the lyrical side and the literary side? What was the... I think most people sort of... Most songwriters either seems to sort of gravitate to one or the other. What did you find easiest? What did you find was the real challenge?
I think I've maybe always been more instinctive as a lyricist. I always enjoyed, you know, English literature at school, and my brief time at university, I was studying drama with, you know, I wanted to be an actor. But largely that was because it was the text. You know, I used to really love, you know, Shakespeare and things, and his turns of phrase and just like the rich linguistic soup that he would serve up. And so I was really interested in words and how they get used. But and then the combining that with music and it really is sort of the two together that totally lit my ring, so to speak. and so for me, like when it comes to writing, I'll very rarely write music without words or words without music.
Right.
For me, you're onto something when you get both things arriving at the same time and they work together and they belong together.
Yeah.
And they support each other. And the idea in the words is supported by the idea in the music, and you know there is a sense of unity of purpose.
Yeah.
And as soon as I have like that idea in my head, then I know we've got something to sort of pull out and turn into something.
And how does that work in a collaborative context as well? Because I know you've done a recent album with Annie Dressler.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember actually, I think one of the first songs of yours I heard was a duet with Duke Special.
Oh, right.
On a Christmas album.
Yeah.
It was like a Shelter thing.
Yeah.
And it remains my second favourite Christmas song of all time. But it's absolutely beautiful. So I see the lights of Lewis at Topcliff High Street.
Yeah.
Every Christmas I always play that and I absolutely love it. And how does that work in a how do you approach that in a collaboration?
Well, I'm really quite inexperienced at collaboration. I've usually been a quite the lone wolf. I suppose as a writer, I'm more in the Leonard Cohen side of things. Like it's long and it's slow and it's painful. and that's kind of how I always liked it to be. You know, there's a lot of suffering goes into writing, and I've liked it like that. And that's just not an easy thing to invite other people into.
Sure.
Because usually when you co-write with people, the idea is you get together for a day and you see how much you can come up with. And for me, like writing a song can take a year. I consider that a decent return.
Really? Yeah, I was going to ask, like, how do you know when a song is done? I mean, obviously you've recorded it and packaged it and sort of gone off, but how do you know when it's is there ever that temptation to just go back and carry on tinkering, or does something happen when you sort of know that's it?
I think so. Well, for me, it's generally when you lose the instinct to go back and keep tinkering. I sort of know when it's not right, and when I don't have that feeling anymore, then I know it's right. And I have, so what I do is I have what I call a period of road testing after a song's sort of there, and there's a few verses and a chorus and it looks like a song and could be considered finished. I'll just try and destroy it. You know, I will criticize it to death. And when I get to the point where I, you know, if parts need changing, if they don't stand up to rigorous interrogation, then I'll try and change them and improve them, or just get rid of the whole song. And when it gets to a point where there aren't any parts that I can't defend, then that's when I know it's done.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
And so, like I said, that process is is to sort of go back to the previous thing, is very difficult to go through when you're just in a room with one person for a day.
Mm.
But I think co-writing is all about sort of trust and the relationship you have with someone, and kindness and patience. I think these are the things, because a lot of the time people will, if someone comes up with an idea, you might just hate it, but what you can't do is say I hate that.
Yeah.
You have to be encouraging and go yes, and try and steer it to somewhere that feels more coherent. And it can be quite difficult, but that's why it's really good to work with people that you have some kind of rapport with.
And did the album with Annie, did the songs sort of come to that? Did you both bring songs to that, or did you write songs together? Because the thing that I think that was the first time I ever saw you live was on that, and just the way that your voices worked together just absolutely perfectly. It was really, really good, and it was crystal clear, and you could hear every word. And there was something about hearing those songs for the first time live that was particularly impactful. Right. And I was just interested, like, how did one of you bring a load of songs, or did you actually write a lot of that stuff together?
I think about half of it was ideas that one or other of us brought to it, and then there were a couple of songs that were just sort of built from the ground up. But she and I have very different ways of writing. She's very quick. She's like a, you know, machine gun writer. So she would just send pages and pages and pages and pages of words. And my thing would tend to be to sort of bat away most of them and kind of go, right, we're taking that one. And then sort of, you know, build out on that, which was actually really useful because one of the things I tend to do is I write in a very inactive way. I sort of sit around and wait for something to come and find me. But that's not, you know, that's not a great way of, you know, you certainly can't be prolific that way. Or certainly I can't, you know, I find ideas come and find me in a very leisurely fashion.
But you've got a reasonable number of, you have released a reasonable number of songs.
I've written hundreds of songs, yeah.
No, but, and like albums, right? You make it sound like you haven't put much out. I mean, it's not like Guns N' Roses standard gaps between albums, is it?
Not quite. Well, I mean, I've been doing it full time since 2001. So what is that, 22 and a bit years. And I think I'm just up to album 10. So that's not too bad. That's one every 2 years and a little bit.
So going back to the beginning, you left uni, you've gone. What was the name of the shit band, by the way?
Oh God. I think it had lots of different bands with lots of different names. I think back then it would have been called Shedley.
Shedley?
Yeah.
Shedley. and how did that morph into Easy World? So Easy World, your first band, presumably that you went professionally with.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the journey from Shedley to Easy World?
So it was me and the drummer were in both groups. Our original bass player was my best friend Omar. He was sort of doing it for me because I was just totally into the band. The band was my everything, and he was kind of going along with it because he was my mate. But he never had the same kind of love for it that I did. So at the same time that I went to uni, he went to uni, but he had the good sense not to drop out. So he, you know, he was out of the band at that point, and I went home, and then we found, I don't even remember how we found her. We found a gal from Hailsham came to be our bass player called Jo, and she was good at playing bass, and that was about it really. I mean, this is how bands got formed back then. Like, literally the only two musicians I knew, I just didn't know people who could play and who wanted to be in a band. And so as far as I was aware, we were the only guitar player, bassist and drummer in Eastbourne. I mean, yeah. I was wrong, there were others, but you know, I didn't have a network to know who they were.
Yeah.
So that was it. You know, we were a band, you know, we had a certain, I guess, musical rapport at the time, and were able to make a decent enough racket. And of course it was the late 90s, and it was the back end of Britpop. And it was sort of the while the music industry was still in what you might consider the old model, which was A&R people go to gigs, discover bands, and sign them without you having to have already sold 20,000 copies or had X number of streams, because nothing was streamed back then. And so that happened for us. We were, you know, I mean, some terrible guitar bands got signed in the late 90s. And I think it was because people were like just desperately trying to go, no, there's still some money to be made from Britpop, so we'll just sort of throw money at things and hope that something, you know, becomes Oasis. And after a while, it became apparent that, you know, nothing was going to do that again. That wasn't going to happen. But for a while there, you know, there were bands like ours that actually got the backing of a label and were able to make wildly expensive records that we had no right to make, and make videos and go on tour in like buses and have roadies and stuff. Like it was ridiculous.
What do you mean you had no rights to make here?
Well, you know, we were an okay band. We weren't a great band, but you know, we had proper, like, you know, major league recording budgets. We could go to proper studios with proper producers and make proper records. I don't know if I felt it at the time, but looking back at it now, I feel like we were kind of a bunch of imposters because we didn't know what we were doing. You know, we were young, but we weren't that young. But we were definitely very green and experienced and really didn't know how to operate in a studio environment or in a music industry environment.
And how were you as a live band? Because if you're sort of going straight into that,
yeah,
you know, really high tech studio and there's a lot of sort of electronic instrumentation and a lot of like augmentation for a three piece, isn't there?
Yeah.
Those albums. Did you feel really confident going and translating that stuff live?
I think that live was always much more instinctive. Essentially, making a record was an attempt to capture what we did live anyway. So it was never sort of the other way around. Like how do you do what you do in the studio live? Because really we didn't know what we were doing in the studio. We kind of knew what we were doing live. You know, we had a certain energy. We made a lot of racket for a three piece because we'd, you know, I kind of absolutely loved like the band Weezer and that whole thing of just like loads of guitar distortion and then play pop songs.
Mm.
Or like, you know, the more melodic end of Nirvana. Essentially it's turn your guitar up as loud as it'll go and, you know, and essentially sing Carpenter's songs. It's that kind of thing. And so and all three of us in the band sang, so we had like three part harmonies and this racket, and it was interesting and novel. The songs were not kind of naive and not very well realized. You know, I was in my infancy as a songwriter, so you know, at the time I thought they were the best songs in the world, but looking back at them now, like I shudder a little bit.
Oh really?
Yeah, you know, I was like I say, very young and inexperienced. And when you're trying to do something like ambitious, like I said, I didn't just want to write songs just to be in a band. I wanted to write songs to change the world. And,
yeah,
you know, and when you're trying to do that, but you haven't got a clue what you're doing, the results can be sort of interesting, but maybe not, you know, some way short of your lofty aspirations.
Mm. Well, I remember, I think the very first time I'd heard Easy World was, I think I saw the music video for How Did It Ever Come to This?
Oh, right.
Which, again, is like, you know, a really big production. Mm-hmm. And is a particularly sort of, that looks like an expensive music video, man.
At the time it was, yeah. I mean, you could make that in, you know, you can make that
on your phone now.
Exactly, right. Yeah. But back then, yeah, I mean, I think they spent like 80 grand on that video or something. It was insane. Wow. Yeah.
I bet you could get a house then for 80 grand.
Yeah,
right.
But they spent more on that video than they did on the album.
What?
Yeah.
No way.
And this was what they used to do in the day. They'd throw money at things. And at the time, they're going, but, I mean, I would have told them not to because they're never going to see that money back. We're like, we're not going to sell enough records to make that money back. But like I said, the music business was a very strange place then. And this is, you know, really, it's projects like that that are responsible for all the changes that went on, where essentially the mainstream music business got taken over by people who were looking at the balance sheet rather than, you know, listening to the music, because essentially people got given a card to just go out and spend all the money in the world, hoping that something kicked off, and the world sort of changed, and it just wasn't appropriate anymore. So yeah, it was kind of Easy World killed the music business.
That should be the name of the greatest hit.
Yeah, I think it will.
And so yeah, I remember seeing that music video. I remember seeing like they're a three piece. Like, how do they do this live? Like, what's that sort of racket? going from that to then your first solo album, which you put out pretty quickly, right, after Easy World split up?
Yeah, band split 2004, I think my record came 2005.
So how much of a reaction to, you know, the big sort of production stuff and the style of the previous band was your first solo album?
It was, I don't know about it being a reaction. I mean, I suppose it was, I've not really thought about it. what we did was, I don't know if I've ever told anyone this, but here goes. So I told our A&R manager, like, about, I mean, months before I left the band, that I wanted to leave the band. And he said, between you and me, like, the label's going under and you're getting dropped and it's all over anyway. So stick it out to the end of the run.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, we'll see what we can get out of it. And so what we said was, so that was back in the day when we'd still release CD singles and 7 inches. And so for all of those, you'd need B-sides. And that would be part of the thing that talked people into buying every single format that would help you get a chart position. So you'd have, you know, you'd have four versions of every single you put out with various different B-sides and all that stuff. So you needed just kind of crap songs to flesh out these releases. That was how they thought about it. And the labels did not care what you put on the B-side, so long as there is something there, you know, to have enough product. You know, that's all they were caring about. And so what we said to the label was, instead of putting us into a studio with the producer to come up with B-sides, buy me a bunch of recording gear to have at home.
Yeah.
And I'll make
the
B-sides.
Perfect. Yeah.
And so that's what we did. So the last few singles, you know, I home recorded all the B-sides. And at the time, I was sort of learning about production and how to make records myself at home. But because that was the process I was going through, I was also writing songs and recording them myself and sort of not giving them to the band, but thinking that's something else. And so, I mean, it was maybe a little bit of, I don't know how much of it was was an underhand plot. I certainly hadn't been thinking about having a solo career or thinking this is going to be my solo record. But when the band actually broke up, I was in the position where I had written some songs that I liked, that I felt were kind of stylistically more appropriate to myself at the time. And also, I'd mostly recorded them all. So that's why it was such a quick turnaround, because essentially, like, the day the band split up, I already had half of my album, like, recorded and mixed and, like, done. And these were the versions that got released.
Mm. But that album's got quite a good rawness to it, I think. So how much of that rawness was intentional? Because I'd always thought that, you know, that was... Some of those songs really, I don't know, like, the emotion in them comes out because of that rawness. Or was that because you were actually learning your way?
Yeah, I mean, the rawness is because I did not know what I was doing. So, I mean, this is, I would say, pretty much all of the reason why that record was successful. And I use the word not in the sense of commercially successful. It was successful in the sense that it opened a lot of doors for me and allowed me to get a good start as a soloist. I think one of the reasons people responded to it was because it was weird. Like, no one makes records that sound like that, because why would you? Like, my record sounds like that because I didn't know how to make a record. And so it was flawed in a lot of ways. And a lot of the decisions that I made were crazy. Like, it opens with two songs that are over 6.5 minutes long, very slow. And those were the lead singles. And you just don't do that. Like, it's madness. If anyone was sort of guiding me or telling me how, you know, trying to get me to make a commercially viable product, they would have kicked my ass and said, you can't do that. You need to rein this in. But I think the fact that those songs don't, you know, they're not structured and presented how pop music usually is, because there was none of that consideration, and they're not recorded the way that a professional, you know, a producer would do them, because there wasn't one, and I didn't know what that process was. they're a lot more, they're sort of more spacious and open sounding, entirely by accident. And so I think people responded to them well, largely because it was just strange. And even though they were just sort of largely acoustic guitar, you know, miserable songs, you would very rarely hear songs just presented like that.
Mm. Were there, if I remember correctly, and I might not, were there other sort of acoustic bands coming out around that time, like Star Sailor and Alfie and Kings of Convenience, or have I got my timelines?
Yeah, right? No, it's about then. It was also, I remember being lumped in very much with Damien Rice when his first album came out. It was around a similar time. Yeah, and I guess there was this sort of, you know, and I was never kind of part of a scene or even sort of consciously aware of it. But there were a bunch of people who were doing these, like, you know,
well, and it's always
sensitive acoustic guitar things.
It's invented by like the Enemy at the time, right? So we cobble a load of bands together to go on an Enemy tour, and then it's right. This is a music scene.
Yeah,
right? But I thought there was some great music around that time. At what point did you start performing solo and looping? Because is it fair to say that you were kind of a fairly early adopter, nay pioneer of the looping pedal?
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say pioneer,
which I might say you have a lot to fucking answer for.
yeah, sorry. Yeah, okay, let's go with pioneer. I'll take pioneer. I actually got into it while I was still in the band. I got a guitar pedal, a Boss DD6. It's just like a delay pedal, but it had this. I think it just had a function on it that was called hold. And if you held it down, like, so a delay pedal is just an echo pedal. So I'm saying that I know you know this, but I'm saying this for the benefit of the listener. So essentially, it just echoes what you play at, and so it's the classic sound of The Edge from U2. Like, you play one note and instead of going gudung, it goes gudung 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 gudung, and it does echoes. Anyway, this pedal, you could hold it down, and rather than it just sort of doing a random echo, it just plays back whatever you play while your foot's on the pedal, and then you take your foot off and it just plays that over and over and over again at the same volume forever until you tell it to stop. And so what I found you could do with that is you could play, like, you know, four chords and then have those repeat over and over again. And then you could play more stuff over the top. And that's basically what looping is. And I thought it was amazing. And there was never an appropriate way of getting it in with the band because, you know, the drummer would have to play in time with this pedal, and it's really hard to get everything to sync up. But it was, but at home, I would play around with it all the time. And, and it felt like a very instinctive thing to do, and a really kind of enjoyable way of being able to make more interesting and rich sonic performances by myself. And I found that, you know, there were other machines available that did a similar thing, but in a more exciting way. And when I first started doing the solo thing, I wrote this song called State of the Union, which was essentially just a four-bar loop. But I sort of wanted to just keep adding more stuff to it. And when I recorded the song, I hadn't even thought that it would be a loop machine thing.
No way, really?
Yeah, I wrote the song, and when I was recording it, I was just adding more things to the recordings, you know, playing as many instruments as I had and just putting another four-bar little moment on top of it. And so it seemed obvious then, when it came to playing it live, that it'd be, well, I can probably do this with the loop machine. And so at that point I got into the, well, now I need to get the piano to plug into the loop machine, and guitars and bass, and essentially just to funnel a whole band into this one little box and then have it come out. And that was, I mean, to be honest, it was doing that if I hadn't done that, you know, my musical career would have ended in 2004, because
in terms of the practicalities of touring, or in terms of an inspirational, like, instrument, or
in terms of anyone ever giving a shit about anything I did, because it was that So I did that. We made a video of it just in Lewis, not far from here, actually. And it was the song and the subsequent video that got the attention of various record labels and people who essentially like bankrolled the early part of my solo thing.
And you still see that influence, like, I know Kate Tunstall does it. I mean, Ed Sheeran's the most well-known exponent, having just played the biggest gig in history, right? Taking, like, the same approach. But to be, you know, that's a pretty big deal to have been, like, the first person to have done that, like...
Well, to be fair, particularly
in that style.
I think Katie was I think of her as being, like, the breakthrough... exponent. I mean, I may have been doing it before she was, but I think, but she was definitely, you know, the one who. I mean, it was the moment she played was it Black Horse and the Cherry Tree? Is that what the song's called?
Yeah.
On Jules Holland, and that was back when. I mean, that show used to be so influential, particularly for me. I mean, some of my, you know, most iconic musical, like. Shock and awe moments were watching that, and I think that was it for a lot of people, like, who had never seen that before. And, you know, to be fair, she absolutely nailed it, and she was really, really good at it. And that performance, I think, was, you know, totally launched her, I feel, and made a lot of people aware that this looping thing was a thing. And so, if anything, you know, I maybe followed in her wake a little. So she was,
That's very. Very humble of you to say.
But I would say we are both better at it than Ed Sheeran is. So there you go.
Yeah. The thing that I thought was so good about that State of the Union, and I think I saw you, I think you finished with that. I think you finished the set that I saw you play with Annie. And this comes across in the recording as well, is that it almost kind of collapses under its own weight, but doesn't. Do you know what I mean? It's like... the craziness of just being like, right, I'm going to throw more at it, and then I'm going to go more at it, and the fact that you almost don't hit the notes, but you do, and there's something about that sort of jeopardy that's absolutely captivating in a live setting, right?
Yeah, well, for me, the jeopardy is everything. Like, I hate the idea of playing gigs where everything's controlled and safe, and you know what's going to happen. Like, I want it to be terrifying. I want the excitement of you take your life in your hands when you step onto the stage, because otherwise, what's the point? Yeah. You know, if you've got like a band that they all know, that they've all done their rehearsal and they know the songs and stuff, and it's going to be the same as it was last night. There's a time and a place for it, but like I'm not so interested in that. I want every show to be like unique and different, and I want there to be about a 50-50 chance that it's going to happen. Okay, like I want it to be difficult, kind of like I was saying about writing songs. Like, I want it to be hard, I want it to hurt, I want it to feel like other musicians that I know think I'm crazy for saying this, but like but I do mean it. Like, I want to come off stage at the end of a show and feel like I'm ruined, like I've got nothing left to give, like I'm like physically and emotionally ruined. And if I don't feel like that at the end of a gig, I just don't feel right, you know?
Right.
I want to come off the stage and just feel just completely, like, you know, destroyed.
Yeah. And do you get nervous? Do you still get any element of stage fright before you go?
No, I don't know if I ever did, but I almost get the opposite. Like, I don't really... And I don't know if it means... that I'm some narcissist or an exhibitionist or something, but like I'd find it very comfortable to be on a stage. It feels really exciting, but in a way that just isn't scary. And so I don't fear it at all.
So getting into sort of more and more writing with a loop pedal, and so that comes with constraints, doesn't it? And constraints are good for songwriting, I think.
Yeah, they can be. Yeah,
you know, it kind of forces you to really make the most of these things. At what point did you think, right, now I need to go out and start playing with a band again? Or, you know, what's your balance of playing solo versus playing with bands? You did an album with a band one before last.
Yeah,
is that right?
So the last record I put out was done with the band. For me, it's there's never any strategy to it. It's always just like what, you know, how I'm feeling at any given time. I love playing with other musicians, increasingly so as I've gone on. Like I mean, in the beginning, I would definitely would say that I favoured, you know, doing everything myself, having, you know, taking a lot of time over it, being able to, you know, really, I don't know, get deep into the process and have it be very immersive. But the last record I made, which is called Love and Death, we recorded in a day and a half with a live band in the studio who had never heard the songs before they walked in the morning. And it was absolutely incredible. The experience was amazing. But I mean, those were absolute, like, elite, top end, like, jazzers.
Right.
And they, you know, they don't need to practice. They don't need to anything. You just tell them, you know, I just wrote out the basic chord structure of the song and counted to four. And then they played the song, and that's the record. It was unbelievable.
Is that the one with, what's it called, when We Were Young?
Yeah.
Like that, you know, what you were talking about at the beginning, when the song, like, really gets you. I remember listening to that for the first time and just thinking, like, holy shit, like, that's a really, really good song. And
thank you.
Really, like, I don't know, just gets you just in the right way, just at the right time. No way. So those musicians, they just turned up and did it on the day.
Yeah, so the version of When We Were Young, that was the first song we recorded for the record. I think that was take two. So take one was, like I say, here's the chord sheets. It's about this fast. And then they played it through. And then take two is the record. And I mean, it still sort of shocks me. So I didn't play anything on that record. It's the first time I've ever done it. I was just the singer, and you know, these expert musicians played every note on it. And so I mean, the chord inversions that Mark Edwards, the piano player, chose for the intro of that song, I just love listening to them, because I can't play that. He's just playing simple, you know, chords that I would know how to play, but he just has the taste and the experience to just phrase them. And so I think for me it was a real eye-opening experience to go, actually, it maybe is a good thing to relinquish control sometimes and let some people who have great skills and great ideas, yeah, bring them forward.
Can I ask about that song? So,
yeah,
is that based on a real relationship?
Or no.
And I was going to ask this about songwriting more generally.
Yeah.
Do you always write about real experiences, or do you sort of create characters, create narratives and whatnot to write about?
I'm quite rare among the songwriters that I know in that I very rarely write about myself or about, like, my own experiences. If I write about real things, it tends to be about, like, news events. So I've written songs that I've got a song called Stephen, which is about a story I heard on the news about the murder of a policeman in Northern Ireland. And so it's a factual song, but it's not about me and my feelings. I'm sort of assuming the character of somebody else who is a real person and writing what I thought her feelings might have been. So I'll do that, but I'll you know, my life and my feelings just aren't that interesting. So I would much prefer to sort of invent characters and tell their story. And so When We Were Young, I mean, it's one of the few songs I wrote very quickly. I wrote it, I was actually on I got invited to this songwriting retreat for Chester Literary Festival, which was kind of an odd thing. But I have a good friend called Catherine Williams, who's a magnificent songwriter and one of the nicest people in the whole world. And she sort of, knowing that I'm a bit of a recluse, she invites me to these things where you have to sort of go and spend time with other creative people and stuff. And it was lovely. And anyway, we all drove to the seaside to get fish and chips. And on the way back, I was driving in my van with everyone, all the other people on the retreat in there. And the song just jumped into my head. And while I was driving, back from the Vision Chip Shop, and by the time I got back to the place we were staying, I sort of had most of the idea of the song. So I took myself off for like half an hour and kind of just wrote it down. And it was largely so in the song. So the first idea I had was this sort of talking about, you know, memories of when we were young and having it being a lovely sort of romantic story about young love. And then it was, there was this sort of moment where I was sort of driving along and go, I think I need to kill her. And so,
not to spoil the plot twist of the song.
So anyway, so the love interest in the story ends up dying. And it was actually that, it was writing that song that led me to think, I wonder if I could do like a whole album about love and death. And which led to the album Love and Death. So that came about very quickly, which is very rare for me. But sometimes it does happen. Like, the muse is sneaky, and sometimes it just jumps straight in your head and gives you a full song, yeah. and then buggers off, and then you're sort of left with it wondering where it came from.
And because, funny enough, you sort of answered another thing that I was interested in, which is to do with sort of honesty and how honest you feel you're able to be, bearing in mind if you are writing about your own life, you're going to be writing about the people in your immediate vicinity, and yeah. You know, you're probably going to be conscious of the reaction that they might have to stuff as well. So I was going to ask, like, how do you approach that? But if you're writing from characters mainly, I didn't realize that you don't write about your own feelings. I'd never sort of noticed that.
No, I mean, very rarely. I mean, I think I write from experience. But I'm never sort of talking about specifically my experience. You know, obviously I'm a human of a certain age, so I've been around long enough to experience a whole load of different things. But even if I am writing about things that are particular to me, I'll tend to bury those in a metaphor. So I'll write about things indirectly. Because I mean, some writers write about themselves incredibly well and are able to do it in a way that's very tasteful. But I feel like if I were to write directly about my own, you know, emotions, for want of a better word, I feel like I'd fall into like cliche, and I don't know. It doesn't feel comfortable for me to do that. So I like to write about such things sort of indirectly, like say to find a suitable metaphor and to write around them. Because for me, the most important thing when you write a song is the most important person is the listener. There's no point being so self-indulgent as to just sort of talk about yourself unless there's some universality that can... Essentially, people don't want to hear about me. They want to hear about themselves. You, when you sing a song to someone, you want them to either empathize or to feel like I've tapped into them in some way. And so I'm always conscious not to make it about me, but to try and make it about you, so that, yeah, not to literally try and write a song about you personally, but something that feels universal enough that anyone could identify with it,
yeah.
But have it feel real. And so the truth doesn't come from it being like literally true, this happened to me, but like emotionally true, that these are how... This is a truthful way of describing the feelings that would happen in that situation.
Yeah, and more like a universal truth, or something that can be more true when it's in fiction. It's like you read something in fiction, and someone says something that you've always thought, but you never sort of articulated. And you think, yeah, that line of fiction is more true than all of the conversations that I've had today. So you say you like playing live to be a terrifying and painful process,
when it's done right, yeah.
And writing as well. Sometimes it comes easy, sometimes it comes hard.
Yeah.
What about recording? Do you enjoy the process of recording? Is that sort of a painful birthing process, or is that something? How does that fit on the spectrum?
No, I like recording. There are lots of different ways to get it done. Like I said, the last record I made took 2 days to make. The one before that took 9 months, and I've done it kind of pretty much every way I could think of.
You know, do you have a favourite album that you've recorded? Or like a favourite sort of experience?
I loved the Love and Death doing it in 2 days live. I mean, I loved how quick it was. It was so great to just sort of get it done. But at the same time, that was terrifying because, you know, on day one, I mean, I hadn't even met all the musicians at that point. I think I hadn't met the bass player. I knew the other fellas. But yeah, you just didn't know what was going to happen. Whereas there's it's much safer working by yourself slowly because you have all the time in the world, and you can keep trying it and deleting it and overwriting it, you know, forever. And I like both ways.
You've got that live jeopardy, but in the sense that you've got those musicians for a day,
yeah,
you're committed to making this. And where did you record that? Is that your studio at home?
The Love and Death was recorded at Echo Zoo in Eastbourne,
okay,
which is a fantastic studio.
Whereabouts is that?
That's in Meads. It's kind of right next to the Grand Hotel.
Ah, I've heard about this. It's quite flash, right?
I don't know if it's flash. I mean, they've got some lovely gear there. It's cool, is what it is. So it's not like one of those ones that it's not sort of all like, you know, like a science lab, like some studios are. It's very kind of like comfortable and cool. But yeah, they've got some great gear there. And the fellow who runs it, Dave Lynch, is a wonderful engineer and producer. And yeah, a really good guy. And I've known him for ages. And so yeah, it was a very nice, comfortable, homely place to make a record. So even though, you know, the idea of it was kind of scary, it felt like a very sort of safe environment to record in.
How much is sort of place important to either your songwriting or your recording? Because you've obviously sort of grown up in Eastbourne, you've done a lot of writing in Eastbourne.
Yeah.
But what's your relationship like with Eastbourne as a musical town?
Well, I mean, Eastbourne isn't a musical town. It's I like living there. It's especially now that I have a little family, you know, it's a nice, kind, safe place to raise a child. But you know, it's not the most exciting, and it definitely isn't particularly vibrant when it comes to there being a music scene, which it bothers me more now that I sort of think of it as like a, just from, I feel like it's almost my civic duty to try and open a music venue at some point, just so that we have one. It never used to bother me before because I would always, it would be quite nice to leave town to go and play music and then come home and it would be nice and, you know, I wouldn't have to think about that for a bit. Like this home would be where I live and then other places would be where I go to work. But the more I think about it, I feel like it would be, I would like for Eastbourne to have a music venue, and I don't mean to be rude to the places in town that do have music, but what I'm talking about is a place that's purpose built for people to come and specifically shut up and watch music,
yeah, sure.
You know, like a room that's made for having proper high end but probably not huge selling artists come and present their wonderful thing that they do to people who are there to appreciate it.
So if you could pick up a venue from anywhere, London, Brighton, wherever, and put it in Eastbourne, what would it be?
I mean, there are venues that are my absolute favourites that I don't think would be appropriate, because I think what Eastbourne needs is somewhere very small. So I'd be thinking somewhere like Green Note in Camden, which is a lovely venue run by wonderful people. It's very small. I think it's 55 capacity at the moment. But I think something like that that has a really well curated, list of talent coming through the doors and a real musical ethos where it's about the show and the experience of the gig goer and the experience of the musician, because the one feeds into the other. So yeah, if we had someone like that, I think it would be great.
And are there kids in bands in Eastbourne?
I don't know. Kids in bands? I think there are. This is the thing. I don't have my finger particularly on the local pulse, but yeah, I mean there are always kids in bands. There are. I sincerely hope so. It would be very depressing if there weren't. I mean, I don't know where they go, where they play. I think they occasionally do gigs down at the Underground Theatre, or the Grove Theatre, as they call it now.
Oh, is that below the library?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a really nice size, a nice stage. It's got decent lights and stuff. It's the sort of place that you could imagine, you know, like a circuit band playing.
Yeah.
But also giving those younger bands really their first opportunity to get up on a proper stage.
Yeah.
And really sort of, you know, feel...
It's a bit big, I think, for my dream venue. it's a little large. It's... I'm very demanding when it comes to my venue, and although the stage is good, the stage is a little high and it's deep, and also, you know, I'm imagining somewhere that is like purpose been thought about for live music. So you know, you'd want to have a very high end permanent PA system and someone who knows how to drive it, and like I say, a room that's probably a bit smaller. And not so. I mean, I really like that theatre. I think it's really nice. I kind of like its sort of 70s decor. But you know, I mean, it's a theatre. You know, is what it is. That's what it's for. That's how it's being used. And that's absolutely great. But you know, the thing I want is something different.
So a little bit grimier. I'm sensing something.
No, I don't know about grimy. Like in my dreams, it's beautiful. It's like a Victorian music hall in miniature. That's what I'm thinking. Like you know, I'm thinking red velvet curtains and gas lamps.
But, this is specific.
Yeah, but
well, if you build it, you know, people will come.
I don't know if they would. That's the thing. Like you know, as we said before, we're told that wherever there's demand, there will be supply, and yet, you know, there has not been the supply, so I guess there isn't the demand. But one of these days, if I can convince someone to give me a bunch of money, I might try and open somewhere in Eastbourne.
Yeah, well, good luck with that.
Thank
man.
You.
I want to ask you about sort of parenthood and being a musician. Mm. So, how old's your daughter?
Six and a half. Yeah.
How has that sort of changed the way that you kind of operate and the way that you write, or if at all, you know, in those sort of 6 years? I mean, presumably it gets easier now that they're...
I don't think it's changed the way I write at all. You know, I still... Because, like I say, I'm not one of those people like, you know, 9 o'clock you go to the studio and you sit down and you work on writing. I'm mostly, I don't know, you could call it lazy, or, you know, I'm sort of waiting for inspiration to strike for the most part. And, you know, that can just as easily strike when I'm pushing my daughter on a swing, or as to if I'm, you know, sitting at a piano or something. I think I've consciously spent less time on tour, which I'm not sure if that... Actually, I'm not sure how conscious that was or how much that's just circumstance. You know, the music business and I are definitely... Well, we were never lovers, but we're definitely not great friends anymore. I find myself increasingly just bothered by the need to beg for people's attention. You know, we're supposed to post on social media 5 times a day, just essentially just begging for people to like me. Mm. And it's like, I came up in a time when to be outwardly self-promoting would be like the most crass example of selling out imaginable. Mm. And you would never want to be seen to be marketing yourself. I mean, that's just so uncool. And I'm still in that mindset where when I see sort of musicians going like and subscribe and like follow me on Patreon, and I feel awful.
Yeah.
And the idea of just having to constantly be, like I say, you know, begging for people to like my music. Like I would be very happy to just, you know, let the quality of my work be, you know, just be judged on that.
Mm.
But you can't even, you can't live like that. You know, you sort of have to, unless you have the good fortune, well, the moderate fortune to be, you know, bankrolled by a big record label. You know, it seems like you have to be constantly reminding people that you exist, and that you're desperate to be loved. And the things I'm not desperate to be loved, I don't care if people, you know, stream my music. It doesn't matter to me at all. That's not why you do it. You do it for the same reason that I said before, because when I was a teenager, I was obsessed with the idea of how you can affect people's mood through music. That's still what I cling to. I don't give a shit if anyone hears it or not. Like, I hope that the people who do hear it are, you know, sufficiently moved by it. But if no one ever hears it, that's no concern of mine. So I feel less and less inclined to beg for people's attention.
Could you tell us about Perry, your automaton drummer?
Aside from being into writing songs and making records and things, I also I'm constantly trying to not trying to. I'm constantly sort of thinking of or becoming lightly obsessed with interesting new ways to present music, and largely like ways that you can do it as one guy on a stage. Like how can you make it visually or sonically interesting? Like how can I fill the stage with sound, but just by myself and not using backing tracks, because that is like something I will not do. Anyway, so I came up with this idea of you know, like the old music box thing where, yeah, you turn the handle and it this wheel turns around and it strikes these little, yeah, things. And I was like, well, I thought I could build one of those, but instead of playing tunes, it will play the drums. And so I built these. I essentially built like a record turntable that plays these 12-inch discs of plywood, and then it had these little electrical switches underneath it, and then you drive screws into the plywood at strategic intervals so that as it spins, it presses the little switches. The switch makes an electrical contact, which drives a little motor which hits the drums.
Nice.
And so what you can do is you sort of program onto these discs the rhythm you want the drums to do. You put it on there and you press go, and then like the actual physical drums will be played. Yeah. So it's like a drum machine, but it's like someone's playing the drums, yeah, but there's not a person.
An analog drum machine.
Exactly. Yeah. and so I had this idea and I built it, and it kind of works, and I took it on tour, and so that's
so you've performed with it?
Yeah.
Okay.
We performed in Lewis with it at the Con Club in March, I think. Did a gig there. It was very nice. Right.
Anyway, is Jerry reliable? Did Jerry get hammered before a gig ever?
Perry.
Sorry.
Perry turned out to be way more popular than I was on that tour. so much so that I ended up making some Perry merch. There are Perry t-shirts. Yeah, people seem to be into Perry.
And have you... So there's an element of tinkering there.
Yeah.
Making things.
Yeah.
So where does that come from? Is that something that you've always done? Or is that just something that's recently you started to...
No, I think I've always explore. done that a bit. Like a lot of the stuff that I use, I've made or certainly augmented. So a lot of the guitars that I play, I've sort of re-engineered a little bit just to work slightly differently. I make a lot of you know, instruments and just like things. Like the loop machine that I use is this kind of bastard hybrid thing that I've made using connecting four different separate loop machines and then wiring them all together and getting them to work as one in unison. So for me, the technical and the tinkering is all part of the same thing.
Yeah.
It comes from like, you know, you have an idea of like, wouldn't it be good if you could do this in a gig? And then you think, well, actually, you probably could do that. But you'd need to, you know, you need to bypass that switch and plug it into a foot pedal, and then you could play that with this. And yes, yeah, so every time I do a tour, I'd generally be there'll be a new like invention that will become part of the show. But for me, the thing is to try and still make it sort of musically like natural. Yeah. So it doesn't feel like a gimmick, you know.
Sure.
It's not like it still needs to be able to support the song. Like the song is the most important thing. Everything works in service of the song. So usually it's build a machine that's going to help the song to be better. And if the machine ends up being, you know, a novelty in its own right, then so be it. But it's got to be a way of making the performance sort of work better.
Yeah.
And is there an element of imperfection? Because I suppose with any live musician, you know, no, that's the difference, right, between a machine and a person. A person won't play it perfectly, but they'll play it with feeling. It sounds like the machines that you're making actually have some element of imperfection in them.
Parasite has imperfection. It doesn't have any feeling. like there are elements at random. Like, and I don't really know why, but sometimes he'll drop a beat, or sometimes there'll be little like pick up interferences from places. And the weirdest thing was, When I first built Perry, I also built this this keyboard out of it's kind of like a Frankenstein of a few other keyboards to sort of do a job that I wanted to. But weirdly, Perry, even though there was no like connection between Perry and the keyboard, sometimes, because I don't really understand electronics and how it works, and I don't know how they were talking to each other, but Perry would do something and the keyboard would make a noise by itself and I wouldn't be involved at all. And it would never sound good. And I don't know what it was, but, you know, there'd be like a voltage would happen and it would interfere with the piano and the piano would start playing. So things like that happen sometimes.
So are you on your own in a room when this is going on?
Yeah.
Does it freak you out a little bit?
I mean, I don't know, freak me out. It certainly is like confuses me because, like, you know, so I'm very much an enthusiast. I'm not an electrical engineer by any means. So I don't really, for me, it's, I can do like, this is connected to that.
Sure.
That's my level of, you know, electrical engineering. So when it comes to understanding like how it is that this digital thing here is somehow receiving a pulse from this very analog thing here and it's triggering like that combination of notes, it's like, in my mind's blown, I don't know what's going on there.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of fun that you know, that these things happen. And like I say, there is, you know, even though it's mechanized, it still feels like there's a human element because I made it and I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Same as, you know, the charm of my first record. I did it and I don't know what I'm doing. And that's, you know, that continues to be the adventure. Yeah. You know, just do stuff that seems fun that you don't really understand.
And that's relatable as a human because, you know, we're imperfect. So, you know, we like that in the stuff that we see, maybe. I've got a couple of questions. I want to ask about writing for other people. Because I know you've written a song for quite a big French artist called Johnny Halliday, is that right?
Yeah.
Tell us how that came about.
Well, like most of the things that have happened in my career, which I don't like to use the word career, but, you know, let's go there. It happened completely by accident. I had a publishing deal, which my experience, I mean, I've been published for most of my life and it's never amounted to anything. I don't really know why I ever had publishers to publish my work as a writer. The idea is that publishers are supposed to, what is the word? They're supposed to make your songwriting profitable. They're supposed to find opportunities, you know, like put it in adverts and in movies and stuff, or find people to do cover versions. And I had a publisher forever, The term of my contract was coming to an end, and so my manager at the time contacted my publisher and said, "You are the publisher of David Ford. Your contract is coming to an end. You know, you can renew it, in which case you owe him a bunch of money." otherwise we'll go our separate ways, knowing that they would say, nah, you're all right. And but instead they were like, oh, I didn't know we had him on our roster. It's like, oh, well, signed to them for like 8 years or something. So this explains why nothing had happened over those 8 years. And they're like, oh, well, but before we do that, let me just pitch you just to a couple of things. So this is the first time they ever pitched any of my songs, and they pitched a song for my second album to Johnny Hallyday's people. And Johnny Hallyday is like the biggest rock star in the history of France. He was, you know, contemporary of Elvis, and, you know, in the French speaking world, you know, he kind of is Elvis. Like that was him. But he was, you know, still going like into the 2000s. Anyway, and his people liked one of my songs, and then he liked one of my songs, and more importantly, his wife liked one of my songs. And so they commissioned a French lyric for it. And he ended up recording it, and it ended up winning the Grammy in France for the best song of 2014. Which was all... And I mean, I didn't do anything. I essentially wrote... when it came out in the UK... As my single, it was quite a flop. It pretty much signaled the death knell of my second album, and then 7 years later, it was a big hit in France, and his album sold like 500,000 copies and physical copies, which nothing sells physical copies anymore. So that was, yeah, and that's
great. How did that feel to have like?
It just felt weird.
The Songwriter of the Year award.
It felt weird. It didn't feel like everyone was like congratulating me, but it didn't feel like, you know, it was the same song that Chris Evans said was shit on the radio, like in 2007. It's the same song. Like, it's no better or worse because somebody sang the same song with French lyrics. It doesn't. The job that I did is no better or worse as a result of what happened. I mean, not to be overly crude about it, it really helped pay the bills for a little while, because, you know, I was I did all right out of that for a little while, but it didn't feel like anything. You know, I'd written the song, it was the same song that I'd written, and that had happened. It did lead to some interesting experiences, in that because of the success of that album, like it was like his first hit album he'd had for a few years, and because the song that I'd written was quite central to it, like I became for a moment a bit of a favourite of theirs, and something that Johnny Hallyday always wanted to do was to release songs in America and in Britain, singing in English. So he always wanted to sing in English. So I got invited to Paris to spend 3 days in the studio with him as his English language vocal coach.
No way.
Which was, I mean, bonkers, because I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not a vocal coach. But like he wanted me because I'm a singer, you know, I'm not a vocal coach. I'm not gonna teach him how to sing, you know, in a formal way, like, you know, my training or experience, if you will, is from being in rock bands and largely listening to American music. So I think he thought that maybe I could help him sing like Elvis or something. Anyway, it didn't work. I learned very quickly that the French palate, the French mouth, cannot make certain consonant sounds that the English mouth can, because they're just not used to doing it, and the French ear can't even hear the difference. And it was illuminating but very frustrating, because I couldn't explain how it is that you pronounce the word true with a hard R sound and not twu or tru. Like he could not hear, and I was in a room full of French people and I was going true, and they were all going true, true. No, do you hear the difference? Ruh, ruh. They go wuh, wuh. And I was like, oh my god, I don't know what I'm doing. I've made a huge mistake. I don't belong here. I was totally out of my depth. But anyway, so there exists somewhere in the world a recording of Johnny Hallyday singing a song I wrote in English that never got released after me trying to teach him how to sing English. Anyway, I ended up writing two more songs for his next album, both of which were his singles. So actually, I think I wrote his last three French hit singles were all written by me.
Oh,
and
wow.
Then he died.
Were they pre-existing songs? Are they songs?
No, those were ones that were written oh, wow. For him. Actually, no, they weren't written for him. They were written, and then though they were co-written with a fella called Andy Hill, who's a lovely fella, and he's a very established songwriter, but he and I had been friends and done a couple of co-writes. He wrote Think Twice for Celine Dion, which was
crikey.
The biggest song in the world for that particular year. He bought a castle after he wrote that song.
Wow.
Anyway, he's a nice fella. Anyway, we wrote a couple of songs together, and those were the subsequent last Johnny Hallyday singles before he died.
Wow.
So that was a kind of a fun little diversion.
Yeah,
but these things always come up by accident, and I've never been particularly proactively. I mean, I've never been proactive from a career point of view, and none of my my management's never been that proactive, and certainly not my publisher. So it's always been sort of fun little accidents that happen, but I like it that way.
Yeah, artistically it seems to work, right? But
yeah, things come up.
You're not reacting to an audience or whatever. Which kind of leads me on to my final two questions.
Okay.
You can answer them in whichever order you like.
Oh, okay.
One is, if there was... Which one song do you wish you'd written that someone else has written? Which one song do you wish you'd written? The other song is, if you could only leave one song behind and the rest of your output, released or otherwise, is just going to be completely zapped from the face of the earth. If you're going to put one song...
Wow, that's brutal.
One song on a spaceship.
Okay, right.
What would you vote? So, in your own time...
Okay, that's that one's going to be tricky. I might need a couple of days to work on that one. I mean, this songs I wish I'd written... I mean... My usual reflex is always on my mind, the Elvis song. For me, it's about as perfect as a piece of songwriting gets. Like musically, it's so elegant in the way it's constructed. All the chord changes are just perfect. They go exactly where you want them to go. The musical flow of all the musical changes are beautiful. I think the lyric is simple and straightforward, but one of the hardest things to do writing songs is to actually be simple without being sort of dull. I love that song. It feels profound, but it also feels incredibly simple. It's like I say, it's very straightforward, but it's very elegantly put together. For me, that's about as perfect as any song's ever been. There are songs that are more complex and maybe more challenging, as from a writing or from a listening perspective. But every time I hear that song, I just think, you can't. I mean, what would you change? It's just so perfect. So that one.
That's okay. A good choice. Well, okay. I thought you were going to say Think Twice by Celine Dion.
That is also a belter.
And if you could pick one song to put in our spaceship that's going off to another planet.
It's tricky. So I think I probably always tend to lean on more recent things. There's a song from my last record, from Love and Death, that's called Prison Tattoo, which is... It's a little bit just different from things I've written before. On every album I think that I've ever made, I think there's always at least one song that is just a rant at the state of the world, and sometimes they're a bit political, And I mostly find after I've lived with them for a couple of years, they feel like they're a bit aimless, or, you know, there are things I wish I'd done a bit differently, or I feel like they lack a certain sort of focus and eloquence. But I think Prison Tattoo is my best attempt so far at writing a sort of this is where we are as a species. It's a very difficult thing to write about. Well, I think when most people write about politics and the state of the world or society, I think they do it very badly. Like it's a real thing of mine. Like I mostly cringe when I hear songs that are pseudo political or about like the decline of society. I think they're most done very poorly. And because I've thought about it a lot, and I've done it a lot, and I've done it badly, and I've done it not so badly, I still keep trying to do it better. But I think that's my best attempt at writing something that's very difficult to write about. And I think that's the best I've done at it so far.
What a perfect way to end. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Chalk It Up. And if you did, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with friends and family. You can also follow us on Instagram at Chalk It Up Sussex Podcast, where you can find exclusive content, including video footage of some of our shows. Thank you for listening.